cried out and pushed her away. "Charlie!" I couldn't see Alice's face, but her gasp mirrored the shock. "No, Alice, I can't. You don't understand." I jumped up from the couch and turned on the light. I almost expected to see him standing there. But of course not. We were alone. It was all in my mind. Alice was lying there, her blouse open where I'd unbuttoned it, her face flushed, eyes wide in disbelief. "I love you," the words choked out of me, "but I can't do it. Something I can't explain, but if I hadn't stopped, I would hate myself for the rest of my life. Don't ask me to explain, or you'll hate me too. It has to do with Charlie. For some reason, he won't let me make love to you." She looked away and buttoned her blouse. "It was different tonight," she said. "You didn't get nausea or panic or anything like that. You wanted me." "Yes, I wanted you, but I wasn't really making love to you. I was going to use you, in a way, but I can't explain. I don't understand it myself. Let's just say I'm not ready yet. And I can't fake it or cheat or pretend it's all right when it's not. It's just another blind alley." I got up to go. "Charlie, don't run away again." "I'm through running. I've got work to do. Tell them I'll be back to the lab in a few days as soon as I get control of myself." I left the apartment in a frenzy. Downstairs in front of the building, I stood, not knowing which way to go. No matter which path I took, I got a shock that meant another mistake. Every path was blocked. But God, everything I did, everywhere I turned, doors were closed to me. There was no place to enter. No street, no room, no woman. Finally, I stumbled down into the subway and took it down to 49th Street. Not many people, but there was a blonde with long hair who reminded me of Faye. Heading toward the crosstown bus, I passed a liquor store, and without thinking about it, I went in and bought a fifth of gin. While I waited for the bus, I opened the bottle in the bag, as I had seen bums do, and I took a long, deep drink. It burned all the way down, but it felt good. I took another, just a sip, and by the time the bus came, I was bathed in a powerful, tingling sensation. I didn't take any more. I didn't want to get drunk now. When I got to the apartment, I knocked at Faye's door. There was no answer. I opened the door and looked in. She hadn't come in yet, but all the lights were on in the place. She didn't give a damn about anything. Why couldn't I be that way? I went to my own place to wait. I undressed, took a shower, and put on a robe. I prayed that this wouldn't be one of the nights that someone came home with her. About 2:30 in the morning, I heard her coming up the steps. I took my bottle, climbed out onto the fire escape, and slipped over to her window just as her front door opened. I hadn't intended to crouch there and watch. I was going to tap on the window. But as I raised my hand to make my presence known, I saw her kick her shoes off and twirl around happily. She went to the mirror and slowly, piece by piece, began to pull off her clothes in a private striptease. I took another drink, but I couldn't let her know I had been watching her. I went through my own apartment without turning on the lights. At first, I thought of inviting her over to my place, but everything was too neat and orderly, too many straight lines to erase, and I knew it wouldn't work here. So I went out into the hallway. I knocked at her door, softly at first, and then louder. "Door's open!" she shouted. She was in her underwear, lying on the floor, arms outstretched and legs up against the couch. She tilted her head back and looked at me upside down.
"Charlie, darling, why are you standing on your head?"
"Never mind," I said, pulling the bottle out of the paper bag. "The lines and boxes are too straight, and I thought you'd join me in erasing some of them."
"Best stuff in the world for that," she said. "If you concentrate on the warm spot that starts in the pit of your stomach, all the lines begin to melt."
"That's what's happening."
"Wonderful!"
She jumped to her feet.
Me too. I danced with too many squares tonight. Let's melt them all down.
She picked up a glass and I filled it for her. As she drank, I slipped my arm around her and toyed with the skin of her bare back.
Hey there, boy. Whoa. What's up?
Me? I was waiting for you to come home.
She backed away.
Oh, wait a minute, Charlie boy. We've been through all this before. You know it doesn't do any good. I mean, you know I think a lot of you, and I'd drag you into bed in a minute if I thought there was a chance. But I don't want to get all worked up for nothing. It's not fair, Charlie.
It'll be different tonight, I swear it.
Before she could protest, I had her in my arms, kissing her, caressing her, overwhelming her with all the built-up excitement that was ready to tear me apart. I tried to unhook her brassiere, but I pulled too hard and the hook tore out.
For God's sake, Charlie, my bra!
Don't worry about your bra, I choked, helping her to take it off. I'll buy you a new one. I'm going to make up for the other times. I'm going to make love to you all night long. She pulled away from me.
Charlie, I've never heard you talk like that, and stop looking at me as if you want to swallow me whole.
She swept up a blouse from one of the chairs and held it in front of her.
Now you're making me feel undressed.
I want to make love to you. Tonight I can do it, I know it. I feel it. Don't turn me away, Fay.
Here, she whispered. Have another drink.
I took one and poured another for her, and while she drank it I covered her shoulder and neck with kisses. She began to breathe heavily as my excitement communicated itself to her.
God, Charlie, if you get me started and disappoint me again, I don't know what I'll do. I'm human too, you know.
I pulled her down beside me on the couch, on top of the pile of her clothing and underthings.
Not here on the couch, Charlie, she said, struggling to her feet. Let's go to bed.
Here, I insisted, pulling the blouse away from her. She looked down at me, set her glass on the floor, and stepped out of her underwear. She stood there in front of me, nude.
I'll turn out the lights, she whispered.
No, I said, pulling her down onto the couch again. I want to look at you. She kissed me deeply and held me tightly in her arms.
Just don't disappoint me this time, Charlie. You'd better not.
Her body moved slowly, reaching for me, and I knew that this time nothing would interfere. I knew what to do and how to do it. She gasped and sighed and called my name. For one moment, I had the cold feeling he was watching. Over the arm of the couch, I caught a glimpse of his face staring back at me through the dark beyond the window, where just a few minutes earlier I had been crouching. A switch in perception, and I was out on the fire escape again, watching a man and a woman inside making love on the couch. Then, with a violent effort of the will, I was back on the couch with her, aware of her body and my own urgency and potency, and I saw the face against the window, hungrily watching. And I thought to myself, go ahead, you poor bastard. Watch, I don't give a damn anymore. And his eyes went wide as he watched.
June 29th.
Before I go back to the lab, I'm going to finish the projects I've started since I left the convention. I phoned Lansdorf at the New Institute for Advanced Study about the possibility of utilizing the pair production nuclear photo effect for exploratory work in biophysics. At first he thought I was a crackpot, but after I pointed out the flaws in his article in the New Institute Journal, he kept me on the phone for nearly an hour. He wants me to come to the Institute to discuss my ideas with his group. I might take him up on it after I've finished my work at the lab, if there's time. That's the problem, of course. I don't know how much time I have. A month? A year? The rest of my life? That depends on what I find out about the psychophysical side effects of the experiment.
June 30th. I've stopped wandering the streets now that I have Fay. I've given her a key to my place. She kids me about my locking the door, and I kid her about the mess her place is in. She's warned me not to try to change her. Her husband divorced her 5 years ago because she couldn't be bothered about picking things up and taking care of her home. That's the way she is about most things that seem unimportant to her. She just can't or won't bother. The other day, I discovered a stack of parking tickets in a corner behind a chair. There must have been 40 or 50 of them. When she came in with the beer, I asked her why she was collecting them. "Those," she laughed. "As soon as my ex-husband sends me my goddamn check, I've got to pay some of them. You have no idea how bad I feel about those tickets. I keep them behind that chair because otherwise I get an attack of guilt feelings every time I see them. But what is a girl supposed to do? Everywhere I go, they've got signs all over the place. Don't park here, don't park there. I just can't be bothered stopping to read a sign every time I want to get out of the car." So I've promised I won't try to change her. She's exciting to be with, a great sense of humor. But most of all, she's a free and independent spirit. The only thing that may become wearing after a while is her craze for dancing. We've been out every night this week until 2 or 3 in the morning. I don't have that much energy left. It's not love, but she's important to me. I find myself listening for her footsteps down the hallway whenever she's been out. Charlie has stopped watching us. July 5th. I dedicated my first piano concerto to Faye. She was excited by the idea of having something dedicated to her, but I don't think she really liked it. Just goes to show that you can't have everything you want in one woman. One more argument for polygamy. The important thing is that Faye is bright and good-hearted. I learned today why she ran out of money so early this month. The week before she met me, she had befriended a girl she'd met at the Stardust Ballroom. When the girl told Faye she had no family in the city, was broke, and had no place to sleep, Faye invited her to move in. 2 days later, the girl found the $232 that Faye kept in her dresser drawer and disappeared with the money. Faye hadn't reported it to the police, and as it turned out, she didn't even know the girl's last name. "What good would it do to notify the police?" she wanted to know. "I mean, this poor bitch must have needed the money pretty badly to do it. I'm not going to ruin her life over a few hundred bucks. I'm not rich or anything, but I'm not going after her skin, if you know what I mean." I knew what she meant. I have never met anyone as open and trusting as Faye is. She's what I need most of all right now. I've been starved for simple human contact. July 8th. Not much time for work between the nightly club hopping and the morning hangovers. It was only with aspirin and something Faye concocted for me that I was able to finish my linguistic analysis of Urdu verb forms and send the paper to the International Linguistics Bulletin. It will send the linguists back to India with their tape recorders, because it undermines the critical superstructure of their methodology. I can't help but admire the structural linguists who have carved out for themselves a linguistic discipline based on the deterioration of written communication. Another case of men devoting their lives to studying more and more about less and less, filling volumes and libraries with the subtle linguistic analysis of the grunt. Nothing wrong with that, but it shouldn't be used as an excuse to destroy the stability of language. Alice called today to find out when I am coming back to work at the lab. I told her I wanted to finish the projects I had started, and that I was hoping to get permission from the Wellberg Foundation for my own special study. She's right, though. I've got to take time into consideration. Faye still wants to go out dancing all the time. Last night started out with us drinking and dancing at the White Horse Club, and from there to Benny's Hideaway, and then on to the Pink Slipper. And after that, I don't remember many of the places, but we danced until I was ready to drop. My tolerance for liquor must have increased because I was pretty far gone before Charlie made his appearance. I can only recall him doing a silly tap dance on the stage of the Alakazam Club. He got a great hand before the manager threw us out, and Faye said everyone thought I was a wonderful comedian and everyone liked my moron act. What the hell happened then? I know I strained my back. I thought it was from all the dancing, but Faye says I fell off the goddamn couch. Algernon's behavior is becoming erratic again. Minnie seems to be afraid of him. July 9th. A terrible thing happened today. Algernon bit Fay. I had warned her against playing with him, but she always liked to feed him. Usually, when she came into his room, he'd perk up and run to her. Today it was different. He was at the far side, curled up into a white puff. When she put her hand in through the top trap door, he cringed and forced himself back into the corner. She tried to coax him by opening the barrier to the maze, and before I could tell her to leave him alone, she made the mistake of trying to pick him up. He bit her thumb. Then he glared at both of us and scurried back into the maze. We found Minnie at the other end, in the reward box. She was bleeding from a gash in her chest, but she was alive. As I reached in to take her out, Algernon came into the reward box and snapped at me. His teeth caught my sleeve, and he hung on until I shook him loose. He calmed down after that. I observed him for more than an hour afterward. He seems listless and confused, and though he still learns new problems without external rewards, his performance is peculiar. Instead of the careful, determined movements down the maze corridors, his actions are rushed and out of control. Time and again he turns into a corner too quickly and crashes into a barrier. There is a strange sense of urgency in his behavior. I hesitate to make a snap judgment. It could be many things, but now I've got to get him back to the lab. Whether or not I hear from the Foundation about my special grant, I'm going to call Niemer in the morning. Progress Report 15. July 12th. Niemer, Strauss, Bert, and a few of the others on the project were waiting for me in the psych office. They tried to make me feel welcome, but I could see how anxious Bert was to take Algernon, and I turned him over. No one said anything, but I knew that Niemer would not soon forgive me for going over his head and getting in touch with the Foundation. But it had been necessary. Before I returned to Beekman, I had to be assured they would permit me to begin an independent study of the project. Too much time would be wasted if I had to account to Niemer for everything I did. He had been informed of the Foundation's decision, and my reception was a cold and formal one. He held out his hand, but there was no smile on his face. "Charlie," he said, "we're all glad you're back and going to work with us. Jason called and told me the Foundation was putting you to work on the project. This staff and the lab are at your disposal. The Computer Center has assured us that your work will have priority. And of course, if I can help in any way..." He was doing his utmost to be cordial, but I could see by his face that he was skeptical. After all, what experience did I have with experimental psychology? What did I know about the techniques that he had spent so many years developing? Well, as I say, he appeared cordial and willing to suspend judgment. There isn't much else he can do now. If I don't come up with an explanation for Algernon's behavior, all of his work goes down the drain. But if I solve the problem, I bring in the whole crew with me. I went into the lab where Bert was watching Algernon in one of the multiple problem boxes. He sighed and shook his head. "He's forgotten a lot. Most of his complex responses seem to have been wiped out. He's solving problems on a much more primitive level than I would have expected."
"In what way?" I asked.
"Well, in the past he was able to figure out simple patterns. In that blind door run, for example. Every other door, every third door, red doors only or the green doors only. But now he's been through that run 3 times and he's still using trial and error."
"Could it be because he was away from the lab for so long?"
"Could be. We'll let him get used to things again and see how he works out tomorrow." I had been in the lab many times before this, but now I was here to learn everything it had to offer. I had to absorb procedures in a few days that the others had taken years to learn. Bert and I spent 4 hours going through the lab section by section as I tried to familiarize myself with the total picture. When we were all through, I noticed one door we hadn't looked into.
What's in there?
The freeze and the incinerator.
He pushed open the heavy door and turned on the light.
We freeze our specimens before we dispose of them in the incinerator. It helps cut down the odors if we control decomposition.
He turned to leave, but I stood there for a moment.
Not Algernon, I said. Look, if and when... I mean, I don't want him dumped in there. Give him to me. I'll take care of him myself.
He didn't laugh. He just nodded. Niemer had told him that from now on, I could have anything I wanted.
Time was the barrier. If I was going to find out the answers for myself, I had to get to work immediately. I got lists of books from Bert and notes from Strauss and Niemer. Then, on the way out, I got a strange notion.
Tell me, I asked Niemer. I just got a look at your incinerator for disposing of experimental animals. What plans have been made for me? My question stunned him.
What do you mean?
I'm sure that from the beginning you planned for all exigencies. So what happens to me?
When he was silent, I insisted. I have a right to know everything that pertains to the experiment, and that includes my future.
No reason why you shouldn't know.
He paused and lit an already lit cigarette.
You understand, of course, that from the beginning we had the highest hopes of permanence, and we still do. We definitely do.
I'm sure of that, I said.
Of course, taking you on in this experiment was a serious responsibility. I don't know how much you remember or how much you've pieced together about things in the beginning of the project, but we tried to make it clear to you that there was a strong chance it might be only temporary.
I had that written down in my progress reports at the time, I agreed, though I didn't understand at the time what you meant by it, but that's beside the point because I'm aware of it now.
Well, we decided to risk it with you, he went on, because we felt there was very little chance of doing you any serious harm, and we were sure there was a great chance of doing you some good.
You don't have to justify that.
But you realize we had to get permission from someone in your immediate family. You were incompetent to agree to this yourself.
I know all about that. You're talking about my sister, Norma. I read about it in the papers.
From what I remember of her, I imagine she'd have given you approval for my execution.
He raised his eyebrows, but let it pass.
Well, as we told her, in the event that the experiment failed, we couldn't send you back to the bakery or to that room where you came from.
Why not?
For one thing, you might not be the same. Surgery and injections of hormones might have had effects not immediately evident. Experiences since the operation might have left their mark on you. I mean, possibly emotional disturbances to complicate the retardation. You couldn't possibly be the same kind of person.
That's great. As if one cross weren't enough to bear.
And for another thing, there's no way of knowing if you would go back to the same mental level. There might be regression to an even more primitive level of functioning. He was letting me have the worst of it, getting the weight off his mind. I might as well know everything, I said, while I'm still in a position to have some say about it. What plans have you made for me?
He shrugged.
The Foundation has arranged to send you to the Warren State Home and Training School.
What the hell?
Part of the agreement with your sister was that all the home's fees would be assumed by the Foundation, and you would receive a regular monthly income to be used for your personal needs for the rest of your life.
But why there? I was always able to manage on my own on the outside. Even when they committed me there after Uncle Herman died, Donner was able to get me out right away to work and live on the outside. Why do I have to go back?
If you can take care of yourself on the outside, you won't have to stay in Warren. The less severe cases are permitted to live off the grounds, but we had to make provision for you, just in case.
He was right. There was nothing for me to complain about. They had thought of everything. Warren was the logical place, the deep freeze where I could be put away for the rest of my days. At least it's not the incinerator, I said.
What?
Never mind, a private joke. Then I thought of something. Tell me, is it possible to visit Warren? I mean, go through the place and look it over as a visitor?
Yes, I think they have people coming down all the time. Regular tours through the home as a kind of public relations thing, but why?
Because I want to see. I've got to know what's going to happen while I'm still enough in control to be able to do something about it. See if you can arrange it as soon as possible. I could see he was upset about the idea of my visiting Warren, as if I were ordering my coffin to sit in before I died. But then, I can't blame him, because he doesn't realize that finding out who I really am, the meaning of my total existence, involves knowing the possibilities of my future as well as my past, where I'm going as well as where I've been. Although we know the end of the maze holds death, and it is something I have not always known. Not long ago, the adolescent in me thought death could happen only to other people. I see now that the path I choose through that maze makes me what I am. I am not only a thing, but also a way of being, one of many ways. And knowing the paths I have followed and the ones left to take will help me understand what I am becoming. That evening, and for the next few days, I immersed myself in psychology texts. Clinical, personality, psychometrics, learning, experimental psychology, animal psychology, physiological psychology, behaviorist, gestalt, analytical, functional, dynamic, organismic, and all the rest of the ancient and modern factions, schools, and systems of thought. The depressing thing is that so many of the ideas on which our psychologists base their beliefs about human intelligence, memory, and learning are all wishful thinking. Faye wants to come down and visit the lab, but I've told her not to. All I need now is for Alice and Faye to run into each other. I have enough to worry about without that. Progress Report 16, July 14th. It was a bad day to go out to Warren, gray and drizzly, and that may account for the depression that grips me when I think about it. Or perhaps I'm kidding myself, and it was the idea of possibly being sent there that bothered me. I borrowed Bert's car. Alice wanted to come along, but I had to see it alone. I didn't tell Faye I was going. It was an hour and a half drive out to the farmland community of Warren, Long Island, and I had no trouble finding the place. A sprawling gray estate revealed to the world only by an entrance of two concrete pillars flanking a narrow side road and a well-polished brass plate with the name Warren State Home and Training School. The roadside sign said 15 miles per hour, so I drove slowly past the blocks of buildings looking for the administrative offices. A tractor came across the meadow in my direction, and in addition to the man at the wheel, there were two others hanging on the rear. I stuck out my head and called, "Can you tell me where Mr. Winslow's office is?" The driver stopped the tractor and pointed to the left and ahead. "Main hospital, turn left and bear to your right." I couldn't help noticing the staring young man riding at the rear of the tractor, hanging onto a handrail. He was unshaven, and there was the trace of an empty smile. He had on a sailor's hat, with the brim pulled down childishly to shield his eyes, although there was no sun out. I caught his glance for a moment, his eyes wide, inquiring, but I had to look away. When the tractor started forward again, I could see in the rearview mirror that he was looking after me, curiously. It upset me, because he reminded me of Charlie. I was startled to find the head psychologist so young, a tall, lean man with a tired look on his face, but his steady blue eyes suggested a strength behind the youthful expression. He drove me around the grounds in his own car and pointed out the recreation hall, hospital, school, administrative offices, and the two-story brick buildings he called cottages where the patients lived. "I didn't notice a fence around Warren," I said. "No, only a gate at the entrance and hedges to keep out curiosity seekers." But how do you keep them from wandering off, from leaving the grounds?
He shrugged and smiled.
We can't, really. Some of them do wander off, but most of them return.
Don't you go after them?
He looked at me as if trying to guess what was behind my question.
No. If they get into trouble, we soon know about it from the people in town, or the police bring them back.
And if not?
If we don't hear about them or from them, we assume they've made some satisfactory adjustment on the outside.
You've got to understand, Mr. Gordon, this isn't a prison. We are required by the state to make all reasonable efforts to get our patients back, but we're not equipped to closely supervise 4,000 people at all times. The ones who manage to leave are all high moron types. Not that we're getting many of those anymore. Now we get more of the brain-damaged cases who require constant custodial care. But the high morons can move around more freely, and after a week or so on the outside, most of them come back when they find there's nothing for them out there. The world doesn't want them, and they soon know it.
We got out of the car and walked over to one of the cottages. Inside, the walls were white tile, and the building had a disinfectant smell to it. The first-floor lobby opened up to a recreation room, filled with some 75 boys sitting around waiting for the lunch bell to be sounded. What caught my eye immediately was one of the bigger boys on a chair in the corner, cradling one of the other boys, 14 or 15 years old, cuddling him in his arms. They all turned to look as we entered, and some of the bolder ones came over and stared at me.
"Don't mind them," he said, seeing my expression. "They won't hurt you."
The woman in charge of the floor, a large-boned, handsome woman with rolled-up shirt sleeves and a denim apron over her starched white skirt, came up to us. At her belt was a ring of keys that jangled as she moved, and only when she turned did I see that the left side of her face was covered by a large, wine-colored birthmark.
"Didn't expect any company today, Ray," she said. "You usually bring your visitors on Thursdays."
"This is Mr. Gordon, Thelma, from Beekman University. He just wants to look around and get an idea of the work we're doing here."
"I knew it wouldn't make any difference with you, Thelma. Any day is all right with you."
"Yeah,"
she laughed strongly. "But Wednesday we turn the mattresses. It smells a lot better here on Thursday."
I noticed that she kept to my left so that the blotch on her face was hidden. She took me through the dormitory, the laundry, the supply rooms, and the dining hall, now set and waiting for the food to be delivered from the central commissary. She smiled as she talked, and her expression and the hair piled in a bun high on her head made her look like a Lautrec dancer, but she never looked straight at me. I wondered what it would be like living here with her to watch over me.
"They're pretty good here in this building," she said. "But you know what it is. 300 boys, 75 on a floor, and only 5 of us to look after them. It's not easy to keep them under control, but it's a lot better than the untidy cottages. The staff there doesn't last very long. With babies, you don't mind so much, but when they get to be adults and still can't care for themselves, it can be a nasty mess."
"You seem to be a very nice person," I said. "The boys are fortunate to have you as their house supervisor." She laughed heartily, still looking straight ahead, and showed her white teeth.
"No better or worse than the rest. I'm very fond of my boys. It's not easy work, but it's rewarding when you think how much they need you."
The smile left her for a moment.
"Normal kids grow up too soon, stop needing you, go off on their own, forget who loved them and took care of them. But these children need all you can give. All of their lives."
She laughed again, embarrassed at her seriousness.
"It's hard work here, but worth it."
Back downstairs, where Winslow was waiting for us, the dinner bell sounded, and the boys filed into the dining room. I noticed that the big boy who had held the smaller one in his lap was now leading him to the table by the hand.
"Quite a thing," I said, nodding in that direction. Winslow nodded too.
"Jerry's the big one, and that's Dusty. We see that sort of thing often here. When there's no one else who has time for them,
Sometimes they know enough to seek human contact and affection from each other. As we passed one of the other cottages on our way to the school, I heard a shriek, followed by a wailing, picked up and echoed by two or three other voices. There were bars on the windows. Winslow looked uncomfortable for the first time that morning. "Special security cottage," he explained. "Emotionally disturbed retardates. When there's a chance they'll harm themselves or others, we put them in Cottage K. Locked up at all times." "Emotionally disturbed patients here? Don't they belong in psychiatric hospitals?" "Oh, sure," he said. "But it's a difficult thing to control. Some, the borderline emotionally disturbed, don't break down until after they've been here for a while. Others were committed by the courts, and we had no choice but to admit them, even though there's really no room for them. The real problem is that there's no room for anyone anywhere. Do you know how long our own waiting list is? 1,400. And we may have room for 25 or 30 of them by the end of the year."
"Where are those 1,400 now?"
"Home. On the outside, waiting for an opening here or in some other institution. You see, our space problem is not like the usual hospital overcrowding. Our patients usually come here to stay for the rest of their lives."
As we arrived at the new school building, a one-story glass and concrete structure with large picture windows, I tried to imagine what it would be like walking through these corridors as a patient. I visualized myself in the middle of a line of men and boys waiting to enter a classroom. Perhaps I'd be one of those pushing another boy in a wheelchair, or guiding someone else by the hand, or cuddling a smaller boy in my arms. In one of the woodworking classrooms, where a group of older boys were making benches under a teacher's supervision, they clustered around us, eyeing me curiously. The teacher put down the saw and came towards us.
"This is Mr. Gordon from Beekman University," said Winslow. "Wants to look over some of our patients. He's thinking of buying the place."
The teacher laughed and waved at his pupils.
"Well, if he buys it, he's got to take us with it. And he's got to get us some more wood to work with."
As he showed me around the shop, I noticed how strangely quiet the boys were. They went on with their work of sanding or varnishing the newly finished benches, but they didn't talk.
"These are my silent boys, you know," he said, as if he sensed my unspoken question. "Deaf mutes."
"We have 106 of them here," explained Winslow, "as a special study sponsored by the federal government."
What an incredible thing. How much less they had than other human beings. Mentally retarded, deaf, mute, and still eagerly sanding benches.
One of the boys, who had been tightening a block of wood in a vise, stopped what he was doing, tapped Winslow on the arm, and pointed to the corner where a number of finished objects were drying on display shelves. The boy pointed to a lamp base on the second shelf, and then to himself. It was a poor job, unsteady, the patches of wood filler showing through, and the varnish heavy and uneven. Winslow and the teacher praised it enthusiastically, and the boy smiled proudly and looked at me, waiting for my praise, too.
"Yes," I nodded, mouthing the words exaggeratedly. "Very good, very nice."
I said it because he needed it, but I felt hollow. The boy smiled at me, and when we turned to leave, he came over and touched my arm as a way of saying goodbye. It choked me up, and I had a great deal of difficulty controlling my emotions until we were out in the corridor again. The principal of the school was a short, plump, motherly lady who sat me down in front of a neatly lettered chart showing the various types of patients, the number of faculty assigned to each category, and the subjects they studied.
"Of course," she explained, "we don't get many of the upper IQs anymore. They're taken care of, the 60 and 70 IQs, more and more in the city schools and special classes, or else there are community facilities for caring for them.
Most of the ones we get are able to live out in foster homes, boarding houses, and do simple work on the farms or in a menial capacity in factories or laundries.
Or bakeries, I suggested. She frowned.
Yes, I guess they might be able to do that. Now, we also classify our children. I call them all children, no matter what their ages are. They're all children here. We classify them as tidy or untidy. It makes the administration of their cottages a lot easier if they can be kept with their own levels. Some of the untidies are severely brain-damaged cases, kept in cribs, and they will be cared for that way for the rest of their lives.
Or until science finds a way to help them. Oh, she smiled, explaining to me carefully, I'm afraid these are beyond help. No one is beyond help. She peered at me, uncertainly now.
Yes, yes, of course you're right. We must have hope.
I made her nervous. I smiled to myself at the thought of how it would be if they brought me back here as one of her children. Would I be tidy or not? Back at Winslow's office, we had coffee as he talked about his work.
It's a good place, he said. We have no psychiatrists on our staff, only an outside consulting man who comes in once every 2 weeks. But it's just as well. Everyone on the psych staff is dedicated to his work. I could have hired a psychiatrist, but at the price I'd have to pay, I'm able to hire 2 psychologists, men who aren't afraid to give away a part of themselves to these people.
What do you mean by a part of themselves? He studied me for a moment, and then through the tiredness flashed an anger. There are a lot of people who will give money or materials, but very few who will give time and affection. That's what I mean. His voice grew harsh, and he pointed to an empty baby bottle on the bookshelf across the room.
You see that bottle?
I told him I had wondered about it when we came into his office.
Well, how many people do you know who are prepared to take a grown man into his arms and let him nurse with the bottle, and take the chance of having the patient urinate or defecate all over him?
You look surprised. You can't understand it, can you? From way up there in your research ivory tower? What do you know about being shut out from every human experience as our patients have been? I couldn't restrain a smile, and he apparently misunderstood because he stood up and ended the conversation abruptly. If I come back here to stay and he finds out the whole story, I'm sure he'll understand. He's the kind of man who would. As I drove out of Warren, I didn't know what to think. The feeling of cold grayness was everywhere around me, a sense of resignation. There had been no talk of rehabilitation, of cure, of someday sending these people out into the world again. No one had spoken of hope. The feeling was of living death, or worse, of never having been fully alive and knowing. Souls withered from the beginning and doomed to stare into the time and space of every day. I wondered about the house mother with her red blotched face, and the stuttering shop teacher, and the motherly principal, and the youthful, tired-looking psychologist, and wished I knew how they had found their way here to work and dedicate themselves to these silent minds. Like the boy who held the younger one in his arms, each had found a fulfillment in giving away a part of himself to those who had less. And what about the things I wasn't shown? I may soon be coming to Warren to spend the rest of my life with the others, waiting.
July 15th. I've been putting off a visit to my mother. I want to see her, and I don't. Not until I'm sure what is going to happen to me. Let's see first how the work goes and what I discover.
Algernon refuses to run the maze anymore. General motivation has decreased. I stopped off again today to see him, and this time Strauss was there too. Both he and Niemer looked disturbed as they watched Bert force-feed him. Strange to see the little puff of white clamped down on the work table, and Bert forcing the food down his throat with an eyedropper. If it keeps up this way, they'll have to start feeding him by injection. Watching Algernon squirm under those tiny bands this afternoon, I felt them around my own arms and legs. I started to gag and choke, and I had to get out of the lab for fresh air. I've got to stop identifying with him. I went down to Murray's bar and had a few drinks, and then I called Faye and we made the rounds. Faye is annoyed that I've stopped taking her out dancing, and she got angry and walked out on me last night. She has no idea of my work and no interest in it, and when I do try to talk to her about it, she makes no attempt to hide her boredom. She just can't be bothered, and I can't blame her. She's interested in only three things that I can see: dancing, painting, and sex. The only thing we really have in common is sex. It's foolish of me to try to interest her in my work. So she goes dancing without me. She told me that the other night she dreamed she had come into the apartment and set fire to all my books and notes, and that we went off dancing around the flames. I've got to watch out. She's becoming possessive. I just realized tonight that my own place is starting to resemble her apartment. A mess. I've got to cut down on the drinking.
This ends Disc 6. Flowers for Algernon, Disc 7.
July 16th. Alice met Faye last night. I'd been concerned about what would happen if they came face to face. Alice came to see me after she found out about Algernon from Bert. She knows what it may mean, and she still feels responsible for having encouraged me in the first place. We had coffee and we talked late. I knew that Faye had gone out dancing at the Stardust Ballroom, so I didn't expect her home so early. But at about 1:45 in the morning, we were startled by Faye's sudden appearance on the fire escape. She tapped, pushed open the half-open window, and came waltzing into the room with a bottle in her hand. "Crashing the party," she said. "Brought my own refreshments." I had told her about Alice working on the project at the university, and I had mentioned Faye to Alice earlier, so they weren't surprised to meet. But after a few seconds of sizing each other up, they started talking about art and me, and for all they cared, I could have been anywhere else in the world. They liked each other. "I'll get the coffee," I said, and wandered out to the kitchen to leave them alone. When I came back, Faye had taken off her shoes and was sitting on the floor, sipping gin out of the bottle. She was explaining to Alice that as far as she was concerned, there was nothing more valuable to the human body than sunbathing, and that nudist colonies were the answer to the world's moral problems. Alice was laughing hysterically at Faye's suggestion that we all join a nudist colony, and she leaned over and accepted a drink that Faye poured for her. We sat and talked until dawn, and I insisted on seeing Alice home. When she protested that it wasn't necessary, Faye insisted that she'd be a fool to go out alone in the city at this hour. So I went down and hailed a cab. "There's something about her," said Alice on the way home. "I don't know what it is, her frankness, her open trust, her unselfishness." I agreed. "And she loves you," said Alice. "No, she loves everyone," I insisted. "I'm just the neighbor across the hall."
"Aren't you in love with her?"
I shook my head. "You're the only woman I've ever loved."
"Let's not talk about that."
"Then you've cut me off from an important source of conversation."
"Only one thing I'm worried about, Charlie. The drinking. I've heard about some of those hangovers."
"Tell Bert to confine his observations and reports to the experimental data. I won't have him poisoning you against me. I can handle the drinks."
"I've heard that one before,
but never from me."
"That's the only thing I have against her," she said. "She's got you drinking, and she's interfering with your work."
"I can handle that, too."
"This work is important now, Charlie. Not only to the world and millions of unknown people, but to you. Charlie, you've got to solve this thing for yourself as well. Don't let anyone tie your hands."
"So now the truth comes out," I teased. "You'd like me to see less of her." That's not what I said. It's what you meant. If she's interfering with my work, we both know I've got to cut her out of my life.
No, I don't think you should cut her out of your life. She's good for you. You need a woman who's been around as she has.
You would be good for me. She turned her face away.
Not in the same way she is.
She looked back at me.
I came here tonight prepared to hate her. I wanted to see her as a vile, stupid whore you'd gotten mixed up with, and I had big plans about coming between you and saving you from her in spite of yourself. But now that I've met her, I realize I have no right to judge her behavior. I think she's good for you.
So that really lets the air out of me.
I like her even if I disapprove. But in spite of that, if you've got to drink with her and spend all of your time with her in nightclubs and cabarets dancing, then she's in your way. And that's a problem only you can solve.
Another one of those? I laughed.
Are you up to this one? You're deeply involved with her, I can tell.
Not all that deep.
Have you told her about yourself?
No.
Imperceptibly, I could see her relax. By keeping the secret about myself, I had somehow not committed myself to Faye completely. We both knew that, wonderful as she was, Faye would never understand.
I needed her, I said, and in a way she needed me, and living right across from each other, well, it was just handy, that's all. But I wouldn't call it love. Not the same thing that exists between us.
She looked down at her hands and frowned. I'm not sure I know what does exist between us.
Something so deep and significant that Charlie inside me is terrified whenever there seems to be any chance of my making love to you.
And not with her.
I shrugged.
That's how I know it's not important with her.
It doesn't mean enough for Charlie to panic.
Great, she laughed. And ironic as hell. When you talk about him that way, I hate him for coming between us. Do you think he'll ever let you... let us...
I don't know. I hope so.
I left her at the door. We shook hands, and yet, strangely, it was much closer and more intimate than an embrace would have been. I went home and made love to Faye, but kept thinking of Alice. July 27th. Working around the clock. Over Faye's protests, I've had a cot moved into the lab. She's become too possessive and resentful of my work. I think she could tolerate another woman, but not this complete absorption in something she can't follow. I was afraid it would come to this, but I have no patience with her now. I'm jealous of every moment away from the work, impatient with anyone who tries to steal my time. Though most of my writing time is spent on notes, which I keep in a separate folder, from time to time I have to put down my moods and thoughts out of sheer habit. The calculus of intelligence is a fascinating study. In a sense, this is the problem I've been concerned with all my life. Here is the place for the application of all the knowledge I have acquired. Time assumes another dimension now. Work and absorption in the search for an answer. The world around me and my past seem far away and distorted, as if time and space were taffy being stretched and looped and twisted out of shape. The only real things are the cages and the mice and the lab equipment here on the fourth floor of the main building. There is no night or day. I've got to cram a lifetime of research into a few weeks. I know I should rest, but I can't until I know the truth about what is happening. Alice is a great help to me now. She brings me sandwiches and coffee, but she makes no demands. About my perception, everything is sharp and clear, each sensation heightened and illuminated so that reds and yellows and blues glow. Sleeping here has a strange effect. The odors of the laboratory animals, dogs, monkeys, mice, spin me back into memories, and it's difficult to know whether I am experiencing a new sensation or recalling the past. It's impossible to tell what proportion is memory and what exists here and now, so that a strange compound is formed of memory and reality, past and present, response to stimuli stored in my brain centers and response to stimuli in this room. It's as if all the things I've learned have fused into a crystal universe spinning before me, so that I can see all the facets of it reflected in gorgeous bursts of light. A monkey sitting in the center of his cage, staring at me out of sleepy eyes, rubbing his cheeks with little old man shriveled hands. Chee, chee, chee! And bouncing off the cage wire up to the swing overhead, where the other monkey sits staring dumbly into space. Urinating, defecating, passing wind, staring at me and laughing. Chee, chee, chee! And bouncing around, leap, hop, up around and down. He swings and tries to grab the other monkey's tail, but the one on the bar keeps swishing it away, without fuss, out of his grasp. Nice monkey. Pretty monkey. With big eyes and swishy tail. Can I feed him a peanut? No. The man'll holler. That sign says, do not feed the animals. That's a chimpanzee. Can I pet him? No, I want to pet the chimpanzee. Never mind, come and look at the elephants. Outside, crowds of bright sunshiny people are dressed in spring. Algernon lies in his own dirt, unmoving, and the odors are stronger than ever before. And what about me? July 28th. Faye has a new boyfriend. I went home last night to be with her. I went to my room first to get a bottle and then headed over on the fire escape. But fortunately, I looked before going in. They were together on the couch. Strange, I don't really care. It's almost a relief. I went back to the lab to work with Algernon. He has moments out of his lethargy. Periodically, he will run a shifting maze, but when he fails and finds himself in a dead end, he reacts violently. When I got down to the lab, I looked in. He was alert and came up to me as if he knew me. He was eager to work, and when I set him through the trap door in the wire mesh of the maze, he moved swiftly along the pathways to the reward box. Twice he ran the maze successfully. The third time, he got halfway through, paused at an intersection, and then with a twitching movement took the wrong turn. I could see what was going to happen, and I wanted to reach down and take him out before he ended up in a blind alley. But I restrained myself and watched. When he found himself moving along the unfamiliar path, he slowed down and his actions became erratic. Start, pause, double back, turn around and then forward again, until finally he was in the cul-de-sac that informed him with a mild shock that he had made a mistake. At this point, instead of turning back to find an alternate route, he began to move in circles, squeaking like a phonograph needle scratched across the grooves. He threw himself against the walls of the maze again and again, leaping up, twisting over backwards and falling and throwing himself again. Twice he caught his claws in the overhead wire mesh, screeching wildly, letting go and trying hopelessly again. Then he stopped and curled himself up into a small, tight ball. When I picked him up, he made no attempt to uncurl, but remained in that state much like a catatonic stupor. When I moved his head or limbs, they stayed like wax. I put him back into his cage and watched him until the stupor wore off and he began to move around normally. What eludes me is the reason for his regression. Is it a special case, an isolated reaction? Or is there some general principle of failure basic to the whole procedure? I've got to work out the rule. If I can find that out, and if it adds even one jot of information to whatever else has been discovered about mental retardation and the possibility of helping others like myself, I will be satisfied. Whatever happens to me, I will have lived 1,000 normal lives by what I might add to others not yet born. That's enough. July 31st. I'm on the